continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. As promised, we are now shifting our focus more to the energy sector, oil and nat gas specifically, as we are chatting with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. It's always great having Dan on the show to share his thoughts on where the oil price is going, natural gas price, and a couple companies that he sent us today. Yeah, we're going to be featuring one multi-billion dollar company and one of the smaller, more, I guess, growth-focused companies in the oil space. If you want to learn more about the Energy Prospectus Group, click the link in the show notes on our website or within your podcast player. Dan, let's start off with oil. Look, oil is choppy, still arguably in a bit of a downtrend, but that $66 level seems to be a pretty solid base over the last really 3 months now, going back to September. However, look, oil can't really seem to get even above $70 a barrel right now. As we're chatting on Wednesday, it's right at that $70 a barrel for crude. Dan, what's going to drive the crude price as it's trading in a tighter pattern here? The big question is it going to break up or break down?
Well, the overall global oil market is much tighter than people think. I believe there's, you know, market forces, whatever you want to call them, a bunch of the, you know, a lot of people investing in stocks, they don't want higher oil prices. They want lower interest rates. So I think there's a bunch of market forces that want to keep oil down because it's the main driver of inflation. If they can keep inflation down, then they feel like they can keep getting more interest rate cuts from the Fed. And I think that's been kind of has oil trapped in this, you know, 67 to 72, 73 range. I'm using $70 in all my fourth quarter forecasts. And I looked the other day, if we ended the quarter today, I'd be slightly above 70 because we started out October and it spiked over 75 for a few days. So the average would be over 70 for the quarter. Now going forward, I believe the right price for oil is 75 or above, 75 to 85. It may take a while to get there. Now remember that the, you know, oil demand is seasonal. So in the first quarter is typically our lowest demand period. And then you get to this from the beginning of the second quarter to the end of the second quarter, there's a significant increase in demand for transportation fuels. So that's usually going to be a driver. And that's when I think it'll break out. I mean, I'm looking here at a 1 year chart of oil and you go back to March of last year, we were above 75 and then it ran all the way up to $87 a barrel in by the beginning of May. So I don't know if we'll get that high, but I will be, you know, amazed if oil can stay under 75 for the entire year next year. I just think the oil market's tighter than, and it's not like, you know, there's all this talk of China economy's in trouble. Well, China is still growing a little bit, but India is taking the lead. I mean, India demand for oil is up like 6 or 7% year over year. So, you know, and it's just as big of a population as China. So, you know, as long as human population is growing, as long as the global economy does not go into a major recession, you're going to have year after year increase in oil demand. So it'll come around. Natural gas, U.S. or North American natural gas prices is a total different story.
Well, Dan, before we get into nat gas, let's just dig in a little bit further on oil as far as the inventories. The EIA report came out and you were kind of weighing in on that as far as the U.S. inventories, but also counterbalance that with OPEC and what you see coming on the market as far as new supply.
Yeah, I was expecting them to announce an increase in crude oil inventory, but they announced a decrease in crude oil inventory. Now, there was increases in gasoline and distillate, but, you know, this is a time of year when you're getting, you know, we're heading to a big travel period for the Christmas holidays at the end of the year. A lot of gasoline is used. So they need to build up gasoline inventories. And of course, diesel is our distillates are used for home heating oil. And now it's a big, as you know, cold wave seems to be going across the Northeast down here. We're getting more and more demand for space heating crude oil, our home heating oil. So that's good. And that'll help. And then you kind of have a low demand. Everybody's filled up their tanks for the winter and that's it. And then you have low demand kind of in January and February. But then you have to start ramping up gasoline production again for the summer months. So anyway, I just think it's tighter than people think. Global observed inventories above ground around the world are at the bottom of the 5-year range. They're not, there's no glut in inventories. There's all this talk of, you know, OPEC's got more supply hitting them up. But then OPEC, you know, the OPEC's now not going to start bringing any more oil back to the market to at least April. And when they do, their plan is to bring it back very slowly. It's not going to be like one day they're going to open up the taps and millions more barrels per day are going to come to market. It's going to be very, very slow. So they're going to manage it. I think OPEC wants oil. I think they want oil like $75 a barrel. And it's Brent's at 73 today when I'm looking at the screen. And I think they want it there or above that price. So I think they can do it if they want to, because they're the only ones with the spare capacity.
Well, let's see where this chart goes, because as I said, it's trading in a tighter and tighter range with the floor being around 66 and change. We'll see. It looks like the chart needs to make a decision here in the next month, maybe. We'll see what that break looks like. Let's move over to natural gas then, because natural gas has been doing quite well. As we're recording this, it's over $3.30. We recently touched that 364 level that was also the high from last year, 2023. Look, it's still way off of any recent highs like 2022, when natural gas ran up to almost $10. What's driving the natural gas price higher here, Dan? Is it simply weather related?
Yeah, it's all weather at this point in time. Now, tomorrow on Thursday, EIA is expected to release a triple digit draw from storage. I've seen projections for the draw being 165 BCF to 200 BCF. If we have a 200 BCF draw from storage, I think it's really going to push up. And then they're talking about polar vortex coming into Chicago in the next couple of days and all this other stuff. Once you get, you know, sub-zero wind chill factors with a lot of wind through these major cities around the Great Lakes, they consume a lot of natural gas for space heating. I have a sister who lives in Chicago, and I can tell you, when it gets below zero up there, it's really freaking cold. Their furnaces just run nonstop 24/7. So that's going to do the trick. So we just really need a normal winter. If we have a normal winter, and then we have the LNG export facilities ramp up to their design capacity, which would be about 17 BCF, up from 14 BCF last year. That should take care of the surplus. And then I think you start looking to the back half of 2025, and we're going to need a lot more natural gas-fired power plants to meet the electricity demand for these AI data centers. I'm following one company that's really benefiting from that. Solaris Energy Infrastructure, SEI, I think we talked about it on the last time I was talking to you guys. And man, it just looks better every time I look at it. And they're very bullish on what they're going to be doing in the next year.
Well, Dan, you brought up two big picture themes in nat gas. So beyond the seasonality, beyond the weather, we keep hearing about these LNG terminals, not just in the U.S., but also in Canada. I would wonder, what effect are they actually going to have? Because you would think with all this news coming for the last 2 years that a lot of it would be priced in this point. A lot of people expected higher, you know, LNG, you know, export, you know, the price differential between what we have domestically and what we see overseas to like raise the prices domestically. And with those AI data centers and more nat gas power plants on the docket to replace at least coal-fired plants or actually new plants, why is there not more demand push into these prices? Why don't we see $5, $6, $7 net gas prices with all these factors?
Well, that's not going to happen until you really drain storage. So until storage goes below the 5-year average, which if we have a normal winter, that could happen in January. Okay, so if we get storage below the 5-year average, then right away I think you start setting a new paradigm that we're going to be short. Now, the one thing to remember, too, on the LNG exports is during the first quarter of 2024, the big LNG export facility at Freeport, Texas, which was 2 billion cubic feet per day, was offline because they had a fire. And then, you know, they kept having to get required all these inspections, everything. They didn't get that thing back online until midsummer, I don't think. So it was down. So we really, even though we had total, including Freeport, about 14 BCF per day of export capacity, we were really only exporting about 12. So once we get Plaquemines is fully up and we get the third train at Cheniere, which is coming on any day now, we should be up to 17 BCF. So you really go from 12 to 17. So that's 5 BCF a day more export capacity per day. So do that over a quarter. So you got 90 times 5. Now you got 450, 500 BCF more demand for U.S. LNG. Now, the thing to remember, I was just talking to one of our members here. He just got back from Europe, and he said they are seriously worried about this winter because they've had a really cold start to the winter in Europe, and European natural gas prices are like $14, $15 per MMBTU. So the profit margin on this LNG is gigantic, and they, you know, with the situation with Russia, they can't count on that gas. So they are heavily, heavily dependent on U.S. LNG imports from U.S. For their gas supply. And that's a big deal. And I think it's going to be a big deal for many years. I don't see any end to that, because natural gas is the cheapest form of energy on Earth. And it's also the cleanest for generating electricity. So that's what we need to be using.
Dan, when these LNG terminals come online, then let's just fast forward to that. What types of companies, in your eyes, truly benefit from it?
Well, it's the producers that can get their gas to those LNG facilities along the Gulf Coast. So the biggies are Plaquemines, Louisiana. It is online now. It is online, and it's the biggest of the three. It's over 2 BCF a day, and it's ramping up, filling up right now. There was a little offshore facility, offshore Mexico, a floating export facility, only about a half a BCF. It's been online for about 6 or 8 months. And the third one is the third train at Cheniere that's going to add another BCF and a half. So you add all those together, I think the three new ones that are online, going to be online the first quarter of 2025, that were not online in the first quarter of 2024, it's a 3.3 BCF per day of total export capacity, those three. And then you add the 2 BCF a day from Freeport, and you're talking about 5 more BCF a day of actual export capacity online in the first quarter. And that's going to make a big difference. So if you have normal winter draws, it doesn't have to be colder than normal, just normal in the eastern half of the United States, the surplus in storage is going to be wiped out. But actually, I was reading this long report from HFI that said that when you look at all the, 100 new LNG or NGL power plants that have to be online in the next couple of years, we're going to have a lot more storage, because these AI data centers are going to run all year 24/7. So that adds to the amount of gas you're going to need every winter. So our current storage capacity is not enough. We're going to have to build another, like a trillion cubic feet of additional storage capacity to balance the market during the high demand periods. So there's a lot of bullish stuff happening for natural gas. I'm very bullish long-term. After we get through this next few months and we can get storage back to normal, then I think you're going to see gas firm up. And I'm using 350 for next year. I think the first half of the year will be actually the low point of the year for gas. It'll be the first half of the year. I think we're really going to see a bidding war for supply between the utilities and the LNG exporters. Could set up a bidding war for supply, which is what caused in August of 2022, we saw U.S. natural gas prices go to $9. I don't know if we'll get that, but it's happened 4 times in history. In the last 25 years, we've had gas over $9, and a couple of those times it ramped up to over $13 in the U.S.
Well, Dan, one more just quick question on some of the companies exposed to nat gas. You've made the point before that there's the dry gas component, the methane, but there's also the liquid natural gas. I mean, not liquid, natural NGLs. Gas liquids. Yeah, yeah, NGLs. So when you look at a company that has maybe a healthy balance of the two, what do you think has more opportunity, just the dry gassers or the ones that have the NGLs?
Well, the one thing, if you have dry, like Comstock is pure dry gas. They have no liquids at all. I mean, Haynesville gas is super dry. But the good thing about the Haynesville is its location. It is located in the middle, between Texas and Louisiana, right on the border. Most of it's in Louisiana. But that gas has direct access to the Gulf Coast LNG export. And so does South Texas. The one thing, it's not just how much gas, but it's where it is. So, Appalachia, which is home to the Marcellus and the Utica, they're pretty much up against pipeline limitation until there's more pipelines built. They can't really increase their production all that much. Haynesville has upside. South Texas has a lot of upside. South Texas, which is home to the Eagleford Shale, they have plenty of pipeline access, and they're closer. You know, they're much closer to the Gulf Coast than the Permian. And, you know, there's more pipelines being announced for the Permian, but the big ones are not going to be online until 2026, 2027. So there's no near-term fix for that situation. The thing in the Permian is more and more of these companies are going to be putting in their own natural gas-fired power plants. They have these modular plants that, you know, you can, you know, you need one of them, two of them. You know, think of it as a big Generex generator that's in your oil field, so you can generate your own electricity to run your pumps instead of just giving the gas away. So they're looking at that, but that's not going to be able to get to the, I mean, some of their gas can is now going there, but they're not going to be able to increase their gas output from the Permian very much just because of pipeline limitations.
All right. Well, Dan, let's move over to some of the stocks that you sent us, starting with the bigger one, Civitas Resources, traded CIVI. This is a $4.6 billion U.S. market cap. Company has two core areas of operation. And let's start with the production forecast here. Q4 production right around 350,000 BOE a day. That's increasing to around 360,000 BOE a day in 2025. So not a huge growth in terms of production. Where do you see the value in Civitas?
Well, Civitas has grown significantly since 3 years ago. They were under 100,000 BOE per day in 2022. So they've grown rapidly. Now, primarily through a series of acquisitions. They grew their position in the DJ Basin. That's Colorado's DJ Basin. That's a little gassy out there. But then they decided they were going to build a second core area in the Permian Basin. And that's what they've been doing with acquisitions over the last couple of years. So that's gotten them up to 350,000 BOE per day. Now they're about 47% crude oil, 28% natural gas, and 25% high value NGLs. So the NGLs do get a decent price, maybe, you know, a third or a half of what the oil price is, but it's still good profit for them. They're an aggressive growth company. They're running 8 rigs today, 6 in the Permian Basin. And the 6 that are in the Permian Basin are in oil-focused areas. So they are trying to push their percentage of crude oil over 50%. And then they have 2 drilling in the DJ Basin. Just without making any further acquisitions, I expect them to increase production about 5% to 10% annually. And the great thing is all of their growth can now be generated, are totally funded by operating cash flow, and they generate a whole bunch of free cash flow. So they're going to generate this year in 2024 about $1.1 billion in free cash flow that's used to pay out dividends, buy back their stock, pay down debt. You know, it's just above what they need for their capital program. And next year, their operating cash flow is going to $3.2 billion. And I'm just guessing that their CapEx program is going to be $2 billion. They haven't officially announced it, but if they keep their active rigs running at 8, it ought to be about the same as it was in 2024. So that should still leave about $1.2 billion in free cash flow, again, to pay dividends. Now the stocks pull back. I mentioned them on your show last year, and the stocks really pulled back. Well, I wrote a profile on that company. I was doing some research on it, and I found out from the company that they've had a large insider, you know, a big institutional investor that has been dumping the stock for whatever reason. I don't know. And so because the stock price got below book value, the board of directors decided to just go back to their base dividend of 50 cents a quarter. But they took the money that was going to be paid out as a variable dividend. They're using it to buy back their stock. And for a company this size, now this company has a market cap of 4.6 billion US. They only have 92 million shares outstanding, which is pretty small for a company with this much production and this size and this much, you know, growth potential ahead. So if they are aggressively buying back their stock, their per share valuations will continue to go up. They don't because they're generating so much free cash flow, they really have no near-term debt problems. There's nothing that I can see that justifies the stock price pulling back. I mean, it's down like 30% or something year to date. And I think it'll bounce back because they told me, they've said that this seller is pretty much done now. So there's no big seller dumping hundreds of thousands of shares all the time. And if they start buying back the shares themselves, that should set a floor under it. Now, my valuation, so it was trading today at 47.25, open on Wednesday at 47.25. And based on the current payout for 2024, the dividend yield is 10.5%. So it's a really nice dividend stock anyway. And if they start buying back their stock, it should start pushing the share price up. I think the timing when they announced that they were going to just pull back to the base dividend, it was during a period, this period of, you know, just a couple months ago when the market was in this, you know, bearish attitude of where oil prices are going, where the gas price, and gas price was still low. And I think in people that had invested in this company and these in the stock for dividends, you know, as soon as they cut the dividend, yield investors are very antsy about a company that, even if they have a very good reason for cutting the dividend, they all hit the sell button and, you know, it causes a sell off. So I think that selling's over. I think they are going to announce a really good fourth quarter, and it does produce a lot of gas. So it's going to get a big revenue boost from increasing gas prices. So anyway, it's, you know, I sent you that one slide that shows that it's got a free cash flow yield of 21%. I mean, that's way at the top of their peer group. It's just crazy where the stock's trading right now.
Well, Dan, I'm glad you brought that up. That's exactly where I was going to go, is if they have the second highest free cash flow yield within their peer group, 21%, that's amazing. And they have been buying back their shares, to your point. But when you look at their valuation compared to the peer group, they're just not there when you look at, you know, their enterprise value based on their EBITDA, you know, different multiples. And you brought in some slides and some of the research you presented to your subscribers talking about the recent selling that you've already mentioned. But what else is behind this mismatch between their free cash flow yields and then where they're valued compared to their peers?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit gassy. And up until just recently, there's been, you know, this feeling in the market that gas was not good. Well, I think that's flipping. And in fact, I saw like three, you know, analyst reports today that are really telling people to switch their portfolios to more gas producers. So if that trend, you know, on Wall Street gets going, and, you know, hedge funds, they're going to be looking for company. Now, Civitas, I mean, for its size, it's pretty much off the radar screen. And I think that's because it's based in Denver. You know, its largest core area is the DJ Basin in Colorado. That the DJ does not get the coverage it should. You know, it's not considered to be like another Permian Basin or anything. And there's also a perception that there's political risk in Denver or in Colorado because the Democrats control Colorado. But the state of Colorado gets a lot of revenues from the oil and gas business, and their governor, I've been to things where he's made presentations out there, and he's very pro oil and gas because of what it does for their state. But anyway, I think this is one of those things, you know, if people start looking for valuation, they're going to see this thing go, wait a minute. I had one of our members, you know, in reaction to our published report we put out the other day, he calls me today and says, I don't get this. Why in the world is this thing trading so low? And I said, well, obviously the Wall Street gang, it kind of agrees with me, because First Call's price target is like $75. And there's the four most recent analyst price target updates on it have all been way above the current share price. I think the highest one was $83 or $84 share price target on it, which is almost, you know, double where it's trading now. So anyway, I think there's just a lot of upside in one. And again, pays nice dividends while you're waiting.
Well, and that's the thing. This is a head scratcher. It pays big dividends. Just the forecast that you have in terms of operating cash flow, $3.2 billion, that's closing in just on the company's market cap, let alone the $1.2 billion of free cash flow. That's what, a four multiple? Not even a four multiple to the market cap. So is there something else here? Is there large CapEx coming? Is there a lot of spending that the company has to do? Is there a lot of debt on the books? Even though you said debt wasn't an issue, is there some sort of a red flag in either of those categories?
Yeah, but there's nothing to justify the stock trading below book value. Think about it. It's extremely profitable. Its reported earnings are going to be like, what, $6 or $7 a share this year. Reported earnings, GAAP reported earnings, are going to be $8.50 a share. So this thing's trading at a PE ratio less than 5. And all growth is funded by operating cash flow, and it's generating $1.2 billion in free cash flow, which can be used to pay off debt, buy back stock, pay great dividends, which they're doing. I don't get it. I mean, there's no justification for this company trading below book value, which this is what, you know, value investors look for. So then you have to ask yourself, okay, they produce oil and gas. Is for some reason where this world's not going to need oil and gas in the near term? No. So, I mean, I don't get it. But this is the kind of thing I'm looking for. And this is the kind of company, exactly the kind of company I like to present to our subscribers, because that's my job. My job's to find undervalued companies and tell them about it.
Well, Dan, it does look very undervalued, that's for sure. We'll keep following along with it. And it's definitely a story that I think should be on more people's radars. I rarely hear it discussed, to your point. But let's dive into another company that you did bring to our attention, which we've had on the show a number of times, and that's Hemisphere Energy, traded on the TSXV under the ticker HME. And on the OTCQX under the ticker HMENF. Now, this is a company that is operating in Canada, the Atlee Buffalo area in Alberta. It has been their bread and butter. They've been doing water floods and then polymer floods. And then more recently, they've tacked on the Marsden project in Saskatchewan, where that's their really their growth profile and their growth platform moving forward. Walk us through why you think this stock is also undervalued, Hemisphere Energy.
Okay, first of all, Don Simmons, the president and CEO of the company, he spoke at our Houston luncheon on Monday, December the 9th. So we got good, fresh information from him. A lot of our members, we had about 40 people at the luncheon. I would say 75% of them have a large stake in Hemisphere. We've been following the company almost since Don became the CEO. I met with him in Calgary. And I was very impressed, just a straight up great guy. I have great confidence in his team. You know, he had come to Houston. His original funding to develop Atlee Buffalo was a private equity company based in Houston. He has since then paid off 100% of that debt. 100% of their investment has been returned. They got a bunch of warrants on the company for funding it. So they are their largest shareholder, and they have no interest in selling. So that's good. And current production, it keeps ramping up. It's current production is about 3,750 barrels per day because it's almost 100% oil. They use their little bit of natural gas that they do produce. They use that to generate electricity in Atlee Buffalo. They run all their pumps off of their own natural gas generators. And so they're really in good shape there, which does keep their cash expenses very low. The one thing he pointed out is they're all cash expenses, which includes operating expenses, production taxes, even their G&A and their interest expense, which they now have no interest expense. They have no interest-bearing debt. So it is a pristine balance sheet, which is why I like it. And even, you know, if Marstan doesn't work out, and I think it will work out, but if it doesn't, they're still going to generate about 10% production growth next year. They have about 10 or 12 more wells to drill and complete at Atlee Buffalo, and then that'll be drilled out. So they need something else. And during Q&A after the luncheon, he was asked, well, are you looking at other deals? I mean, you got all this free cash flow. Why don't you go buy something? Why don't you get some production going? And he said, we're looking at stuff all the time. We're not going to spend something that doesn't look good to us and is in our area. They're not looking in the U.S. or anything. They're looking in Alberta, the areas that they know quite well. And so anyway, but, you know, it is generating a lot of free cash flow. Like we were talking before, this year, their operating cash flow is going to be about 55 million Canadian. Their capital program is only 21 million Canadian. So they're generating this year, 2024, 34 million in free cash flow, which now that they've paid off all their debt, they're just going to keep, if they don't buy something, they're going to keep distributing that as dividends. They have quarterly dividends of 2.5 cents per share, but they pay two special dividends of 3 cents per share. So if you add that all up, they paid out in 2024, 16 cents, which is dividend yield of what, about 8.7% dividend yield, Canadian. Now, if you're a U.S. shareholder, they withhold 15% on those dividends, but you do get that back as a foreign tax credit on your tax return. So anyway, but the Marstan field, so, you know, he gave us an update on that. They have completed 5 wells in Marstan. They're all horizontal wells, 5 horizontal wells. So let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the number 2 and number 4 wells between the others are injector wells. They are already injecting water that has been, you know, upgraded with the polymer flood and those three producers. So they have not reported any production there yet, but they should report a little bit of production there in the fourth quarter. And then it'll take them probably till mid-2025 before they're 100% sure the polymer is going to work. And so it could become a big part of their capital program in the second half of next year. But it's not going to be significant production in, from Marston until you get to like 2026. But they're still going to increase production next year, I think about 15-18% just at Atlee Buffalo.
So when are we going to find out? What are some of the timelines around assessing what's happening at Marston, how successful these floods are?
Yeah, he said they should know something about 6 months. The first thing you start seeing is downhole pressure increase, and then you get, you know, higher fluid production coming from the three producers. And but this is a big area. I mean, it's 13 or 14 sections of land. So they're just, this little pilot program is just one small area. I mean, there may be room for 100 horizontal wells there. So it's a big development potential. And, you know, when I was talking to him before on the phone and stuff, he's told me that we're talking about, you know, if it's successful, if it's what they think it's going to be, could, you know, double Hemisphere's production in a couple years and maybe triple it in 5 years or something. They're going to go. The one thing about Don is he's very conservative. He's going to go slowly. He's not going to go crazy drill, baby, drill until they know stuff's going to work. And he wants to keep the company free cash flow positive, and he wants to keep paying these big dividends year after year. I think the wives of the management team really like that.
Yeah, I think everybody likes the big dividend year after year. But let me ask you this. I mean, he was very successful. Their team has been very successful in the Atlee Buffalo with both the initial water floods and then the polymer floods, and they brought on a lot of wells. But talk to us a little bit more. You mentioned how big the land package is at Marsden. So talk about, you know, the growth profile. Let's assume that it does work. Like with that caveat out of the way, if it works, how big is Marsden as far as, you know, you said there's room for 100 wells, but what could they realistically do in 2026, 2027? Give us a sense of the growth the company could go through if this thesis plays out.
I mean, if it works, I mean, across the entire acreage block, you're talking about a tripling of their potential production. But the one thing you also said, and I didn't know, there's like two other zones besides the one they're flooding that are potentially have oil in them. So which have been produced with vertical wells. So they know there's a significant amount of oil in place. So what they're just trying to do with the polymer flood is make that from oil in place to recoverable oil. And once they start getting credit for that in their year-end reserve report, that's what's going to drive the share price higher. And the thing is, you know, companies, especially the ones with pristine balance sheets, they don't trade below the value of their proven reserves for long before somebody walks in and makes a big, you know, offer for their stock or something. Because, you know, there's people looking for stuff like this, and especially when it's already free cash flow positive. And the thing about polymer floods is they have very low decline rates. Like, he's got low single digit decline rates in that field. And actually, he showed us charts of the you know, how the wells have been doing at Atlee Buffalo. The original, like, 42 wells that they had drilled before they started polymer floods there, they've actually increased. They haven't had a decline in production. They've increased production significantly above what their primary production was. So the polymer flood is definitely working. That's proof that it's working at Atlee Buffalo. And, you know, when I was at Hess, we had several very successful tertiary recovery projects, especially in the Permian Basin. We had the number one CO2 flood in the world in the Seminole San Andreas unit. And that unit went from like 12,000 barrels a day. It was a big property, but 12,000 barrels a day to 64,000 barrels a day. And it stayed at 64,000 barrels a day for like 8 years before it went on decline. And he was saying at the luncheon, he says they're expecting Natalie Buffalo to plateau, you know, maybe in 2 or 3 years, but then to stay at that plateau for several years. So that's what I really like about this. This is not like some shale, you know, wells that come on strong and decline rapidly. It's not anything like that. This is a strong asset that should provide, you know, I mean, it's generating over $50 million of cash, of operating cash flow right now.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Hey, Dan,
no
nice
kidding.
Cash flow numbers. And as you said, that pristine balance sheet, no debt. That
yeah, and
is
real,
also
and real low
G&A.
I'm real low G&A. You know, he has a fairly small staff. So it isn't like this company has all this, you know, salaries going out the door or anything. It's a very cash flow machine.
Hey, look at how well the share price has done, too. Entering 2021, the share price was a penny stock, practically. It was around 10 cents a share. Now it's right back to, well, it recently touched $2 a share just a couple months ago. So a couple opportunities there that Dan Steffens has shared with us. Again, Civitas Resources and Hemisphere Energy. And Dan, great chatting with you. Again, if you want to follow along with Dan and the Energy Perspectives Group, click that link in the show notes. Dan, it's great having you on the show. And everybody, thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Be sure to go back to our website, kereport.com, and podcast. Just search the KE Report in your podcast player to follow along with all our daily editorials, company updates, and, of course, extended versions of this weekend show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.